podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
It is Tour Live. It's Neil Atkinson with Phil Blundell, with Sean Bennett and with Mike Bankhall. The last one before Christmas, and we will be getting Christmassy at the start of part four of this Tour Live. There have been sent some questions to contemplate well and truly in advance in a Christmas environment there. Mike, Sean and Phil all psyched up for that. Also, coming up, we've got Mike Hill and Jeff Shreves to talk about their respective books, one about World War One and the other one about being Jeff Shreves.
Who wrote which one?
It would be really
funny. Really good if Jeff Shreves wrote World War One. But
yeah, I'm Mike Stone.
Would buy.
Yeah, and Mike Stone, a real study of this, the life of Shreves. It is worth reading. Both of them are worth reading, and they are both to come, and I've done both the interviews, so I don't have to say thanks to John or anything, which always feels a bit awkward and a bit odd at the start of Tour Live. But anyway, it is Christmas. We will be getting on to the Boxing Day fixture against Aston Villa, but we will start it off with a discussion about Manchester City 3, Liverpool 2. And Mike, before we speak to Phil, who went to get an in-depth analysis of the Manchester City light show, we will start off with the football. And ultimately, from 20 seconds onwards, it struck me as a really weird game, a slightly untamed game for both sides. I think we were weirder and slightly more vulnerable than Manchester City, but they themselves were a somewhat odd football team as well. It didn't really feel like any other game of football I've ever really experienced. And I'd say that was like solely a good thing. I don't even entirely mean that. I had a lovely time, don't get me wrong. I had a lovely night, but I was left just... I felt like I had more questions than answers about Liverpool.
Yeah, it's a really weird game to kind of analyse because you don't know where to position it in terms of analysing the game. Because it isn't, in a grand scheme of our season, it's not like a devastating loss. We've lost the League Cup game. Of course, we'd love to win trophies, but ultimately, I think having less games on our fixture list, given our priorities, is probably a good thing. And especially when the draw comes out and it's away at Southampton, you're thinking, you couldn't be bothered with that. You couldn't be bothered with that at all. So it's actually one of those losses. It's a blessing in disguise. But it reminded me a bit of the Community Shield game in that both sides go into that game in a weird place. We played two preseason games or a few preseason games. City played no preseason games. And we were going into that game slightly fresher than they were. And we kind of had the edge. And I think this time they had the edge in that they have players who have rhythm in guys like Rodri and De Bruyne who've been playing at the World Cup. We have young players in our midfield. Our midfield, we're going to talk about it, was very lightweight and very small, which is something you've spoken about in the last 24 hours, Neil. So it is a weird game to analyse. And it's not the only worrying result for us would have been getting whacked and getting really beat really, really heavily. But you can lose that game and we show some desire and some spirit at times to come back from behind twice. And we do create loads of good chances. So it's a game you can say, look, Liverpool, they're going to count themselves. The game doesn't mean much in the grand scheme of things. Let's move on, take the positives and also learn from some of the worrying signs which we have seen over the course of the season.
Sean, there's something about, I think it's odd when there are disparities in terms of not between two teams, but internally within teams. When you've got different players in different places, and that can be the case for fitness at times, and it makes games a little bit strange. But it can also, I think, just be the case when, like, the thing I was really conscious of was that, for instance, the most inexperienced Manchester City player was the right back. And so I end up just thinking all the time, why don't we just attack the right back constantly? But that's not useful from a Liverpool point of view in terms of development. But there's a part of me that's going, I don't really care about development, just attack that right back over and over again, please. Put Nunez right behind him and just keep putting the ball over the top. And that is, it's not useful, I think. And that's what one of my takeaways from the whole game really is exactly how useful is Manchester City 3, Liverpool 2 to anybody at this stage?
I think it was telling that Klopp said in his press conference, the lineup was only confirmed a few hours before the game. And if anything, he seemed buzzing that they managed to react to that and come out with a decent enough game of football. It wasn't perfect, but we showed a reaction, and I think we showed a reaction twice. Potentially would have been a third reaction if Nunez finishes on another day. So that's why I came away from it like weirdly content. And then I'm watching Klopp's press conference after it, and he's just smiling. He's laughing his head off. He's laughing his head off in that press conference. He doesn't seem that worried about it. And he said,
the odd little laugh with Guardiola as well during the game, which Phil might not have been seen because he was there, but they had that odd little sort of semi-conversation for 10 seconds laughing about something, and it was all quite odd.
Yeah, I know the League Cup's not the top priority, but going out of any cup competition, you'd expect the narrative from the players and the manager to be a downbeat, kind of respecting that going out of any competition isn't what you want at a club like Liverpool. But I don't even think Klopp even said the words about, like, we should have won, we could have won. He was just like, it is what it is. He said something like, I saw enough encouragement that I can take into the Villa game. So whether those changes last minute changed much of what they were going to plan to do, and he was just happy that they were able to adapt to an extent where we were still in the game up until, I'd say, you know, 90 minutes. I think my biggest issue was just a lack of movement in general. I felt like we were ball watching, we were static, we weren't tracking runners. You've only got to look at the third goal.
Well,
like not tracking two runners back post. Who do you even blame for that? Like, I was not one person in like the whole game. Even the keeper shouted for that. And we just felt like we were stuck in the mud and sleepwalking a bit. But I'll try and give them the benefit of the doubt and think it's a bit of rustiness, a bit of getting up to speed, and a bit of, you know, the first 11 not really being back, and a last minute change, it seems, to the lineup.
What worries me, Phil, if you're looking for the negatives rather than the positives, is just a couple of the things that we saw in the first part of the season you get a little bit of. So as an example, for instance, I don't like the knocking off. And I feel like there was a fair bit of knocking off that was going on through the game. And the biggest example of it actually becomes the third goal. Only Henderson goes to deal with the fact that they're going to take it quickly. No one else goes out there. Henderson's actually on his own in 20 yards of space by the time he gets there, because no one else has clocked. They're going to try and take this quickly here. And it's knocking off that worries me. You know, it's arguably what happens away at Arsenal, as an example. General football almost from Liverpool doesn't worry me at the moment. It's other little bits. It's lots of the nuts and bolts of the game. And maybe my concern, if I am trying to sort of find a way to talk about this game, my concern is that stuff's the stuff that needs to stop.
Yeah, I think last night was a lot about sort of removing rustiness from players, because a lot of those players haven't played proper football for 6 weeks. There's obviously just people who went to the World Cup. I think there's only, you know, Nunes who went to the World Cup started, and I think everybody else has basically done nothing. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that's what they've got to adjust to everything again, get right up to the pace of the game. It's also possibly that they're not quite, they're a little bit leggy, even though they only play 50, 55 minutes or whatever, that they've not done that at that intensity for such a long time. Yeah. That's almost what last night was about. It helped both managers that it was the fourth round. In that, if it had been a semi-final, or if it had possibly even been a quarter-final, there's probably a little bit more sort of, right, we actually need to win this, you know, because if either side losing the fourth round of the cup to the opposition, like the literal opposition, as in we lose to Manchester City, we're basically now going, well, yeah, you know, that happens, it's fine, there's no disgrace in losing away to Manchester City. I think it would have been the same the other way around. And what it did is it gave them the opportunity to sort of be a little bit relaxed about how they do things, and I think that was possibly in part led to a level of the rustiness and the switching off. I think Henderson was really interested for that goal. We were very high last night, which we aren't usually, and you got a fantastic view of everything. And Henderson was fuming with how he was basically just on his own trying to cut this corner off. I think, I can't remember who he was closest to him. It might have been Chamberlain, but I can't quite remember. And he was like, well, you should have been closer to me. And he looked very annoyed. But it's one of those. You win on Sunday. It's Monday. I don't honestly. I've lost track of days, and it's not even started yet.
I know, but it is Monday.
Yeah.
Boxing Day. Just call it Boxing Day.
Yeah, let's
give them all the title.
The 26th.
Let's give them all the formal title from this point on. It was Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, Boxing Day, the day after Boxing Day, etc. I could go on.
We've got that the 28th is still a bank holiday as well. It's got no name. You can't even call it the day after Boxing Day.
We need to sort something. Yeah, we'll come up with something. Yeah. So there'll be a saint.
Get a man on it. We'll get someone on it.
if we can find out what the patron saint of the 28th is.
This feels like something Gutman could do.
Yeah,
Gutman could box the 28th.
Yeah, he could give it a title. We can sort all of that out and go from there. There is, the shape is, to me, Mike, of interest. I think that the 45 Carvalho, 45 Chamberlain, is of interest. I think if that was a test for who's going to play the game against Villa, I think that Chamberlain possibly wins it in the end, which is an odd thing to say given the fact that Carvalho scores the goal in the first half with a really, really neat finish. I think that the shape itself, it just felt too little. And that's a weird thing to say, because that's not actually about the shape, but it's more if you're going to try and play in that way and only play with only three midfielders, you need them to be physically imposing and getting themselves around the pitch. And it felt that City were able to play in the spaces that those players were leaving.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the big issues I have with our team at the moment. It just feels like it's a team that can be bullied in spells and can be overrun in spells. And I think yesterday we see that in that the midfield just isn't as powerful as City's midfield. And it's weird because City have gone on a journey where they were the team that were really technically gifted and had like kind of these small magicians and these like David Silva. Fernandinho's quite a small lad, but he's tenacious and strong, don't get me wrong. But it wasn't the most like physically imposing midfield you'd ever seen, that kind of 17, 18 City midfield. And now you fast forward, you have Kevin De Bruyne in there. Rodri's an absolute monster, probably the best number six in the world. And then they have like sometimes Gundogan in there. Bernardo Silva's a fairly robust player. So yeah, I thought the shape was weird. One thing I didn't like about the shape was like, I really want us to build a shape around Salah and Nunes being so close to one another. Like, that's something I really want us, our shape to be for this next few weeks, given that we have injuries in the front three areas, given that Salah and Nunes both look to link up with each other and link up with each other well. I think that really is way home for us over the next few weeks. I think moving forward, any shape we look to kind of put out on the pitch has to have those two really close together. So that was one of my main concerns. And yes, you see for the goal, Nunes' pass, the composure he shows to get the pass to Salah is really, really good. He's running at top speed. It's like Torres speed. Down the channel, squares it to Mo with such composure. And I think what's interesting about their relationship is that they always look to play one another in.
Yeah.
And there is that genuine, like, I want to play you in. I want you to score. So I think moving forward, that's a really good route home for us because Nunes is the architect of chaos and Salah is one of the best forwards in the world. So if we can get those two combined, then that's a really, really positive thing for us, I think.
It is a positive thing for us. But Sean, the concern for me is at times I think we're asking footballers to do stuff that doesn't suit them. And... you know, I'm struck more and more every single time I see a team. Mike mentions there, Man City is a really good example of it, and that I think that is the thing they've taken from us since 2018. You know, they are more physically imposing, and it is something that I feel as though Liverpool have conspired to drop the ball on a little bit. I think there's too many footballers that Liverpool are picking on a semi-regular basis who just don't look as though they're quite at the physical level and demand that is going to be in the game. And when you want to play a really physically intensive brand of football, which the manager does, that is going to create a problem for him.
Yeah, the midfield was light, but just tiny. Like, that's got to be one of the smallest midfields we've ever put out on a pitch. And it's saying something when Mata goes for that run forward, which eventually leads to the goal. And I'm sat there thinking, is Mata the thing we need in midfield? I don't even know anymore. And then you're looking at City's team, and yet we both didn't go full strength, but they had a full strength midfield. And I think it was just night and day, the difference between what we put out. And then you've got Carvalho, yeah, doing his best, scoring a goal. But I just can't remember anything he did apart from the goal. No lasting impression on me whatsoever.
It's funny, Phil. I think, again, picking Elliot and Carvalho, you always end up feeling like you're picking on one of them, not least because they're both obviously technically gifted footballers. But when both of them are playing, you almost feel like you're picking on both of them. But when both of them are playing, I think it does just make Liverpool diminished in a really key area, really key facet. And I still feel that both of them ultimately could just be number 10s. And we don't play with number 10s. And the managers had very little interest in playing with number 10s. And again, I'm just still not entirely sure where either of them are going to fit into Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool. And that this isn't a conversation really about whether or not they're good, because I could see how they could fit into a number of top six teams in different areas. I just don't quite see how they fit into Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool.
Yeah, it feels like he's trying to play number 10s at number 8, doesn't he? Which is possibly not the best idea. They're both technically excellent footballers, I think. They're both very switched on. They know the right thing to do. They know what to do. The problem is, they're not big. Not big or strong seems really harsh. It just feels like you're sort of being unnecessarily mean, but they are, you know, they're both sort of 5'7" and they are.
But neither of them are genuinely quick either.
No, that's exactly what I was going to say, you can get away with that if you're offering the ability to break on a team and run past the fullback just by literally kicking the ball and running around them, which is what some 5'7" footballers can do. Like, I'm pretty sure, for example, if we'd have played Ben Doak last night, who's a 17-year-old who's done very little for the club, he could have got the ball, kicked it past that Rico Lewis, was it?
Yeah.
Ran around the other side, and that might have actually made a difference, which is not even necessarily saying he would have done something with the ball, but that was one way to sort of get out of jail. I don't know if you saw, did you see the pass map that someone stuck on Twitter before?
No,
it's insane. Like, I'll try and find it for you. It doesn't really work in the medium of live effectively radio, does it? But
they'll be fine.
It's mad. I think it's beyond the posts or something on Twitter, if you want to Google it.
Yeah,
it's like, no, they're usually a bit mad past match and they're quite hard to understand, but this was like no shape or structure that I've ever seen anything before. It was like three players were sort of on top of each other between sort of centre mid, right back and centre back area. It was really weird. And it sort of felt a bit like last night that there was a lot of, he's just throwing players on the pitch. If it works, it works. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. We get players up to speed. That's what I feel like he'd sort of calculated the fact that losing was okay last night. I know that will annoy some people. Doesn't bother me personally, but I think a lot of what he did last night in terms of decisions was based around the fact he didn't really mind if we lost, and it was more like get players on the pitch, get them minutes, get them fresh.
I mean, he doesn't mind if he lost. I'll come back to you on it, Phil. First, you've seen now that Meg's already mentioned they're going to Southampton away. That's coming in between the third round of the FA Cup and our game away at Brighton. If they get through that, and I'd like to think that they would, and I'd like to think that if we'd have gone through, we'd get through that as well. It's then back-to-back games either side of the Chelsea game in the semi-final, because that remains two legs. What suddenly hit me was there's been very, very, very few blank midweeks for this manager, his players, I think in 18 months, which is startling to sort of think about, but it'll actually give them some time to work together on the training ground.
Yeah, it also means that you're not putting miles into legs as well in terms of having a period before the sort of the push from the spring. Like, spring has traditionally been ridiculous for Liverpool, and we've had rearranged games. I mean, our last free midweek last season was in January, I think, wasn't it? And this time we've got three in January. It's such a change of pace what the manager's used to and how he's able to prepare players. They'll be able to do a lot more stuff on the training ground as well. I thought they'd clearly done some things on the training ground, though. I thought it was really interesting that they basically decided to copy Napoli's way of taking goal kicks against us.
Yeah.
Because I think we actually had centre-backs taking goal kicks. Like, Joe Gomez took some goal kicks last night. I'm pretty sure that happened and I wasn't imagining it.
Yeah.
Like, that's a completely alien thing to us. Kelleher was very, very confident in where he was passing the ball as well. Like, he was passing the ball backwards at times, and he was waiting until someone was right in his face. Now, obviously, that can go badly wrong, and we've seen it. Remember, we scored a goal at Chelsea a couple of years ago against Manchester City. Manchester City final last season. Yeah. It does have the ability to go wrong, but it's also different. And it is something that was different for him. And they've clearly been working on things. So they get January to do even more of that when they're all back, because that's the key point. They've had time on the training ground the last sort of 6 weeks or however long. I know they went on holiday, whatever, but you now get them back. You get them all together, and that will be valuable for them, I think.
Okay. Last thing is that light show. Mike, what the fucking hell are they doing?
Honestly, just weird. They were like flashing faces and names on the pitch. I just didn't get it. I don't get much of the stuff they do to kind of cultivate an atmosphere, but that's arguably the most bizarre thing they've ever done in their entire history. They've done loads of bizarre things. It was just so weird.
I think it was genius, because it was that fucking weird. I think for the first 10 minutes, all of our players were still replaying it in their heads, thinking, what's just gone on? And I think that explained the first 10 minutes of the game, because it was just that jarring that it gets in your head. It's still in my head now. The thing that got me was at the end, they went through like the players' names and the heads, and it just said disco on the grass for like 5 minutes.
Disco really threw me.
So I'll be honest, I think the maddest thing about all the team stuff, right? So when they introduced Gundogan, he was like, the man who scored the title-winning goal. Yeah. I was like, yeah. They get to a kanji, right? And have you seen the thing he's got where you can basically just throw two numbers at him, multiply them, and he can do it instantly like that?
Honestly,
it's incredible. Like, it's an incredible talent. It is on YouTube. They actually said, number 24, the human calculator. I was like, you can't introduce someone in the team sheet as the human calculator, regardless of how good he is at maths. Like, it's a dart. That's a dart thing. You can walk out to the darts, which is a useful thing in darts as well.
Very useful.
Knowing how you finish off 121.
Yeah.
That's very, exactly very what you need to do.
Yeah.
What you need to do. Probably treble 17.
It's 20. So 20 it's 20. It's treble 17, yeah. Double five. That's a way home. That's a way home, yeah. But I mean, that's the first one I thought of.
I was treble 17, 20.
Yeah, no, that's fine as well. Yeah. Good. In fact, I think they go for that one rather than my one. People don't like double five.
Because I think they go the 20 first.
Yeah, because also if you go underneath.
Then if you go 17, you get to 74, 84. Yeah, it's 84. That means you can leave yourself on 40.
Yeah.
36, 32.
I'll tell you what, this is what people subscribe for, this shit.
Yeah, we need to. Maybe they've got a point at Man City, that's all I'm saying.
Yeah, maybe they have. Indeed. And does Akanji watch the darts?
If he doesn't, he should.
He should. He should. He'd go down very, very well indeed at the Ali Pally. We can do more darts chat if you want. That is coming up. It is Tour Live. We will move ourselves on to the other bits of the show. We've got Mike Hill talking about his book, and we've got Jeff Shreves talking about his book. Lots and lots of book action for you there. If you are listening to this podcast, if you are enjoying it as Tour Live, there's been a number of comments all the way through. I just wanted to deal with one of the early ones. Somebody asks what we think of Childwall. Doesn't exist, mate. Most places in South Liverpool don't. They're mostly absolute myths, to be honest with you. And we talk loads and loads about transfers and people investing more in the club. It's like exhausting. We do it all the fucking time. Yeah, it's just ongoing, to be honest with you. Anyway, that was part one. In a minute, I'm joined by Mike Hill to talk about his book, Christmas Truce by the Men Who Took Part, Letters from the 1914 Ceasefire on the Western Front. It's an oft-discussed thing. This book by Mike's is just raw primary source material. And I don't say that to denigrate it in any way, shape or form. When Mike sent it to me, he actually said, you'll read it like it's almost like reading a poetry book or something. And that's sort of the way in which it's transpired. I haven't read every page, Mike. I'll say this on the show and be honest and upfront, but I've read lots of it. And there is a remarkable poetry to some of the language, because these are what you've collated here are the letters either to newspapers or to relatives of the men who were part of the Christmas Day Truce in 1914. Firstly, there's so many of them, there's recurring themes, but these are good letters is sort of my point here. These are some of these letters are absolutely beautifully written.
Yeah, that's exactly why I put them together in the book, to be honest, because I'd done a project looking at the Christmas Truce, and I'd come across the letters, and it never really occurred to me that people would have written about it. And I thought, well, there's probably a lot out there, and there's probably a lot of them have been long lost, as it were. So I started gathering them together, and after a while, I had several hundred, and I thought, I need to do something with these, because there are some beautiful letters in there, but there's also lots of little stories that got lost in the mists of time. That when people talk about the Christmas Truce, they tend to talk about one or two different things, but there's little stories, just little incidents, just, you know, between two people that have been lost, and then there they are recorded in letters, and hopefully it brought them back to life for people. And you know, that's something that people find of interest.
Yeah, no, I think there's a few bits that really sort of captured both, well, the imagination, I suppose, is the way to frame it, even though, you know, it is depicting, you know, what literally happened. The number of the recurring theme of joint services around graves just comes up again and again. And what I mean by joint services is that the, you know, is German and British soldiers gathered together to not just for the process of burying the dead, because I've always known, but I've known about the burying the dead part. It's an opportunity to bury the dead, and that all feels rather grisly. What you learn from these letters is that it wasn't just, you know, the act of we've got to get this out the way, etc., etc. It's the act then of joint and shared services between these two warring representatives of these two warring nations who've literally just been shooting at each other. And they gather and they share this moment of commemorating the dead on either side.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that really the truce, that's how the truce has come about. If you find yourself in a trench that's half full of rainwater because it's early on in the war and they haven't been developed properly, and it's the middle of winter and it's cold and it's miserable. And about a week before, there'd been some battles, so there was quite a lot of dead bodies on the strewn around the battlefield. There's almost a practicality there of, you know, you're looking out at essentially your dead mates and your dead colleagues there, and you're in pretty grim conditions. So the idea that sort of they could broker a temporary ceasefire, not just to be able to put your head up without the risk of getting shot, and, you know, not just to get out of the water and so on, but also to give your colleagues and your comrades a decent burial and respectfully, not just leaving them out there, which was, you know, you can imagine was a pretty grim sight. And I think from having a service, and as like you said, there's several services took place, and that's quite a somber moment, as it would be in normal circumstances. I think there's almost naturally a sense that you want to have a moment of relief after that, and then that's when people started shaking hands and talking. Really, once the sort of, I'd say the tension, but once the sort of sadness of the ceremony was out of the way.
There's also within there that, again, there's not a homogenous response. There's one I noticed because he was from Seaforth. There's a Corporal John Ferguson in there who, you know, the colonel, the British colonel, when the Germans approached, sent them all away and said, we're going to shoot you. and they'd been calling out to each other, but they then sent them back, and there wasn't some sort of grand moment. He goes into a fair bit of detail, Corporal John Ferguson, within here. But again, I think that that's something that's really important as well, is that there was not one homogenous thing. The nature of it being organic obviously therefore meant that different soldiers took it differently. There was one soldier who, for instance, writes about refusing to get out the trench because they shot, as far as he was concerned, they shot my brother about a week and a half ago. And, you know, in our minds, I think we have this sort of hugely poetic image that this whole thing sort of came together in that way. But the flip side is that there are these individual things that happen that don't fit the sort of the established narrative of, well, they all got up and they all played football and everyone had a lovely time.
Yeah, I think you're spot on, because what it is it's not one truce, it's a series of truces. At that time, I think the Western Front would have been about 20 miles, the British sector. And I think it was probably about two-thirds of that sector there was different individual truces that broke out in different ways. And I think word of mouth probably started one or two of them. But it'd be about a third of that line where there was still shooting going on and still you know, people killing each other, literally yards away from where people were shaking hands and, you know, swapping, you know, souvenirs and that sort of thing.
So with all of this, then, you know, you obviously published it and collated it, and you've mentioned a couple of historical texts in there, you know, your background working on newspapers. Have you considered writing about this in greater detail? Have you considered writing about it in a different way? Have you considered addressing this? Or, as far as you're concerned, is the work just solely this collation and then you hand that over to others?
Yeah, the idea is just to leave it at that, really. There is a book out there which I'd say was the definitive account, if we're honest, but this was a different project. There's a different piece of work, actually. Coming from a journalistic background, I like the idea of people telling their stories, and to me this was the opportunity for people to tell their stories. You can't go and interview them, but these are individuals reliving their experiences for quite an extraordinary day. And I think in that sense, I was quite glad just to leave it at that. I did ponder with the idea when I was putting them together, whether to put it in a historical context and discuss, you know, what had happened previously, what happened afterwards. And some of that's alluded to in there. But I think other people have done that and done that very well.
And I think also that's, when you say it's in there as well, you know, these letters, they do go into that detail either side. There's a lot of talk of the Battle of Ypres on the 19th of December. That's a recurring theme through those ones over and over and over again. And it strikes me that, you know, within there, they are doing they're offering their own testimonial within there. But you've also been really clear in both in the foreword and also throughout that you wanted these accounts to be as contemporaneous as possible. This isn't someone writing about it in 1926. And it coming back. This is the idea of it's in the immediate aftermath of Christmas. A lot of these letters are written literally between Christmas and New Year. And that's the way in which you've grabbed this. But they give themselves the context that you're talking about.
Yeah, the reason I did that was actually the football thing. Because people talk about it's become a day of football. And actually what you find is that in the months afterwards, as soldiers are coming home with injuries, people were asking them about this. You know, reporters quite often, and they were talking about how they played football, and things almost started to get embellished a bit and get their own legs and little stories running away. So I really wanted to cut off at a time period where they hadn't, sort of urban myths and urban stories hadn't started circulating too far. So I really tried to keep the letters always written up until about the end of January. There's one or two others in there from different periods, and I've flagged that up in there to let people know, just because I thought they had added value. But I wanted to get as close to the truth as possible, really.
And the other sadness in it is that they're all talking about, you know, the exchanges are in there around, hopefully this will be over soon. Some are openly saying, but I don't think it will be. And as they're going backwards and forwards, you know, there appears to have been another recurring theme all the way through is that in the conversations that these men had with each other, it was very much that they didn't want to be doing this, that they wanted it to be finished. And that, again, comes up no matter which. The reportage is all obviously from the British side, but it comes up in the fact that that was the exchange of views that these men were having.
Yeah, and I think there's possibly a reason for that as well, is that I'm not suggesting these guys were any way friends at this point, but they didn't hate each other as much in December 1914 as they did by the following spring. I think the war turned on the introduction of gas attacks around then, and there was a real hatred between the sides. It wasn't quite there. And the other thing is that I think a lot of the German side who were involved in truces were Saxons regiments who felt more kinship with the British soldiers and perhaps some of the Prussian regiments and so on as well. So I think there's almost a, not a reluctance, because there was that sort of loyalty to king and country at the time, but there was a they weren't as invested in killing as the war became, I think.
There we are. Do check it out. It is very much worth looking through. And as I said before, if you're firstly, if you're looking for a Christmas present, but also in the aftermath of Christmas, I think it's published by Fonthill. It is called Christmas Truce by the Men Who Took Part. Letters from the 1914 ceasefire on the Western Front from Mike Hill. It will challenge a few of your preconceptions about that period of time. They're all tinged with elements of sadness as well. But it is a pleasure to have read and worked through it. Thank you very much to Mike, and let's get back on with the show. Delighted to be joined by Jeff Shreve to talk about his book. Cheers, Jeff. Tales from the Touchline. There are tales from the Touchline. Jeff does do tales from the Touchline in there, and you can read them if you read the book. But there's something else you can read if you read the book, and it's how Jeff got into this in the first place. And we've talked recently with a number of people, Daniel Gee as an example, about opportunity and about waiting for your moment to grab some sort of new venture, some new direction. And Jeff, the way in which you ended up getting into this is to me absolutely staggering, but it shows how open-minded you were, and also how much you just sort of felt, well, let's have a go at this. And then within that, you managed to make friends and you managed to showcase what you could do when you got the opportunity to do it, going all the way back to 1990. Italian 1990 is where you got your break, and it was solely through chatting to a friend of yours.
Yeah, to be honest with you, Neil, I've labelled this kind of my sliding doors moment. I've tried to think of an appropriate football analogy. And the best thing I can come up with is a drop ball, because anything can happen, can't it? I was in a completely different route for the first 5 years when I started working adult life. I worked in property. First of all, started working in estate agents. Then I started building houses. I was in property development. And although I was friendly with a number of footballers, particularly Arsenal players, because where I lived in Hertfordshire, it's where they trained and lived, then came the crash and I lost all my money. I really didn't know what I was going to do. I had no idea. And I was walking to see a friend of mine, a guy called Kevin Luckhurst, because he's always a cheerful, upbeat guy. And I walked in his office and he's on the phone. And he said, yep, the guy you need right now is here. He'll do the job for you. No problem. Put the phone down. I said, who's that? He said, it's my brother. I said, oh, Brian. And I knew Brian because he had buildings and maybe wanted a bit of a hand with a development or something like that. Neil, I was that skinny. If it was 10 weeks labouring, I'd have done it. Anything. And he said, no, it's my brother Mick, who I'd heard of, a former kicker for the Atlanta Falcons. And he was an unusual story himself. He says, he's going to the World Cup in Italy. This is 1990. He's looking for someone to carry his bags. I said, you do it. And it just the most random, wonderfully bizarre, unexpected moment. So I went after a series of terrible auditions and trials, which I spectacularly failed at, left, right, and center. But Mick and I hit it off famously. But when I got there, my eyes were opened to this incredible world. You know, I was a football fan like everybody else. I played locally to no great standard whatsoever, and I just really, really enjoyed the journalism aspect, in particular the fact that it was football 24/7 and broadcasting, all three things that I loved from afar were now within reach. So I networked like mad while I was there, and then of course where I got really lucky, when I came back within 2 years, Sky had started the Premier League television coverage. So it was very much it's a case of right place, right time for me.
There's also in there, so it's interesting you talk about very briefly in the book, and you've just mentioned it there too, your background in property development, your background in an estate agent. One of the things that those, if you do those jobs well, let's be clear, because some people don't, but if you do those jobs well, part of what it is getting along with people, being able to make common ground from there, being able to push a relationship to the point that it works for you. And what's really fascinating as the book sort of wears on is that that's effectively what you're doing with, I'd say, three different minimum generations of managers and players. Is that you've taken those skills that you were honing there, and you're then using them to develop in this other sphere where it very much is, you know, you mentioned their journalism, but a massive part of that is literally being able to get along with people, have people tell you things. You mentioned ringing Dennis Wise at the training grounds, and he just gives you the team news for the week, because why wouldn't he? He's a nice enough fella, and you and him get on. And that feels like this is a massive part of, you know, what you did actually feeds into what you go on to do. It isn't as simple as you were just a different person. You were still the same person. It was just a completely different landscape, but it was a landscape that A, you loved, and B, you felt you could work in and then did.
Yeah, very much so, because it's about working relationships. Whatever you do to do successfully, if it's in particularly the communications business, which we are, it's about building relationships. So then you break that down further. It's A, how you make the initial contact, the very first impression you make on somebody, how you maintain that relationship, and where it becomes tricky, but the test is, it could be a player or a manager who you've got a tremendous relationship with. They might have helped you with news, with little bits of information, all sorts of things. And then you've got to push them quite publicly on something that is one of their failings as well. And that's a real test of a relationship too. So these things, they don't change in terms of your relationship, but the ground shifts quite considerably often, and the relationship is tested. But that's part and parcel of the job, and 99% of people accept that. They don't turn around and say, oh, you're supposed to be my mate. You can't ask me questions like that. It doesn't work like that. For instance, Lampard and Gerrard, that was really interesting when they became managers. These were two players who were fantastic with me when they were players. When winning major trophies, they always made time for me. Have great personal relationship with them then, and I still have now. But when they became managers, managers get scrutinised far more than players. And they both made it very clear that they said, "Look, if you don't ask me the questions that should be asked, we are borderline insulted. We want to be treated the same as other managers. You ask what you've got to ask," and that helped me hugely as well. So recently, when Stephen was in trouble, Aston Villa, he knew it was coming, no problem at all. Frank, when he's faced difficult times, a Chelsea manager, the same. So I understand why you hone in on it, because it's a unique dynamic in many ways, the relationship. There's no set boundaries either. It's what both parties feel. There's no written contract. It's what both parties feel is fair.
What's within the book that where you cite that what you try to do? So, for instance, if there's something that pops up on one of the Sunday papers and you know that you're going to be in touch with them today, you say beforehand, "I'm going to ask you about this." And you don't try to get them in a gotcha moment, because as you sort of frame it there, the answers are more important than the questions. So they might not like that the question's coming. It might not be something they want to talk about, but you at least prepare that for them every single time. And I think this is times there are examples where football could do with more capital J journalism, a lot of the work that's done by David Conn. And then there's the idea of too much stuff that people might feel is a little bit underarm, a little bit softball towards people. But the key part about this is, as you say, what football supporters and what Sky did really well to start with, and everyone else had to catch up. Sky understood, you understood, that your job was to get the information that the football supporters themselves wanted out of the managers. It wasn't A, to trip them up on the one hand, or B, say, "And what are your lovely regards for the nation" on the other. It was instead to find a way to get what would be talked about in pubs up and down the country out of the managers. And part of doing that was, for you, was to allow them a minute to think, to prepare the ground before you ask them the difficult question. And I think that's quite an insightful thing to have chosen to do, when you discuss it in the book really well.
Well, we, first and foremost, at Sky, we had to earn all the players and the managers' trust, because we were the new kids on the block. You know, who are these Johnny-come-latelys? It's like if a new newspaper or website was launched now, people say, "Okay, let's have a look at this." And, you know, people are suspicious. There is a certain scepticism amongst them. So you've got to earn their trust, first of all. You can only earn that by being trustworthy. Secondly, what I would say is, warning managers or players that there's a curved ball coming. It's quite rare, and anything within football boundaries is absolutely fair game. No problem whatsoever. I'll give you a recent example. Leicester City got humped at Tottenham, and the clubs have to put up a player. So James Maddison was brought in. And I said to the Leicester media officer, I said, "I need to ask him about England," because he'd been left out of the England squad, well, most recent England squad. And that, as you know, there was a clamour for him. So before I did the interview, I said, "James," I said, "what's the game? You okay if I tag one on the end about the England squad?" And he went, "Yeah, okay." So we'd had the conversation and he knew it was coming because I thought it was unfair to just hit him with it. And then we do the interview, it goes out, and not that social media is a barometer of morality by any stretch of the imagination, I got absolutely pilloried for asking about England when his team had just been humped. I think they got done by 6-2, I think it was, something like that, I can't remember. And it looked like bullying, but I wouldn't ever ask that sort of question out of context without asking him first. I think that's fair. I think that's just being fair.
I agree more. I think that, because also, he's just literally played a game of football, and I feel at the minute, with some players, Jeff, they are put up immediately after having played, and then one or two of them might say something that people might deem to be a bit daft. But the point about this is they've just literally concentrated on one thing and run around for 90 minutes and possibly got beaten. It's an emotional game. You want it to be an emotional game. And I always feel as though, you know, those players themselves, they need it's interesting you talk in the book a little bit about the terrible circumstances around Gary Speed and, you know, Craig Bellamy, and how you mentioned something around that. That's an extreme example. But I feel at times some of these footballers need a little bit of a duty of care, looking after them at key moments. And that also has to, and I'm sure it does, it sort of includes you as well. You've got to make sure that they're protected at the moment where they're asked a certain question, so is the people around them. And you've got to help them out with that too. And you've got to consult with them before you do it.
Yes, but at the same time, we want to capture the raw emotion, and you want to get their real feelings as well. Come on, Neil. You know, it's a bit like in football, you know, when there's a melee between the two subs benches and some commentators say, we don't want to see this. Yes, we do. The whole country's thinking, yes, we do. We love seeing these things. So you want that drama, that rawness, that emotion. That's the best part of post-match. And it's not we're looking to trip people up. You're getting the real person. Not when it's calmed and they've been advised by media officers and it's a bland statement. Whether it's often you can get a better interview from a losing player, you know.
Absolutely.
Which is... And the other thing is that what I love about it is, and I still love about the jobs these days, no two interviews are the same. They're never the same.
I remember you did one post when it was falling apart the second time around for Chelsea with Jose Mourinho. And you asked him, I think, two questions and he spoke for 12 minutes. I remember watching, oh God, that this literally, I was watching this person. And I genuinely, and it's you know, from a Liverpool point of view and from a general life Jose Mourinho point of view, he's meant to be someone who, yeah. And I remember afterwards everyone said, oh, there's Jose playing mind games. And I was thinking, this isn't a fella playing mind games. This is a fella who realises that this whole thing's falling apart around him. You know, when you do those sorts of interviews, are you almost at times sort of stood there looking at them? Because we can see them and we can't see you. Are you almost at times almost looking at them thinking, you're going to some dark places here, Jose? I mean, you know, we all know Jose's very resilient and he'll be fine in the end. But that one, I just remember watching him and he was, I think he just lost another home game, really soft, really stupid. And he said he'd just been in the dressing room and he didn't know what to say to them. And he was just talking to you and talking and talking. And it genuinely felt as though you were almost like a confessional for him. Was there almost part of you going, this is brilliant, but come on, Jose, you're going to have to stop in a minute or two?
No, you never think that. Because don't forget, we also have to be careful as well. Back to your earlier observation about duty of care. It's our job to report the news and then tell people what is happening. So we can, so often questions are, they are questions, but they're also prompts as well. And that, you know, Jose can go off on one, or sometimes he might give, well, I prefer not to speak. That's one of his. And it's a simple, why is that? Ah, because da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So it's, you know, I like an interview, and I love all interviewers in all sorts of sports and other subjects as well. I always liken the job that I and many, many others do as well. It's a bit like being a bowler in cricket. You wouldn't bowl the same, and make it clear, I'm not trying to catch anybody out, but you wouldn't bowl the same way to everybody. Sometimes a fastball, sometimes you flight it up a bit, sometimes it's a bit of spin. It's what works for that person. Some managers or players you have to corral. You have to really, really make it clear. And this goes back to you judging, as you're walking towards, you're judging your whole relationship. Like at the moment, two top managers in the Premier League are Pep and Jurgen. I approach them completely differently, completely differently. So it's, you can't also take, or say you do, let's say on the rare occasion I do a really good interview, I can't take the template from that and then take it over here and do exactly the same as someone else, because they're different people. That's the beauty of it.
When you're within the book, talking about those early days at Sky and how disruptive it felt like Sky were, little details that you just sort of point out that now are accepted as commonplace, for instance, score and time in the top left hand or top right.
Yeah. The clock.
Letting people know what how long's gone in the game was deemed to be genuinely like, what on earth are these people doing? How dare they shake up the game? The way in which things move on. How dare someone who switches on know what the score is immediately? how long there is to go. But just to sort of close off, because the book is very much worth reading, I think this is one of the main reasons why the idea of going back, and you say, you know, budgets were manic. There was a lot of money Sky paid in order to get the football, but it was very much being done back then, not very much not now, on a shoestring. Is there still something about you when you look back on those times when you enjoyed the sheer adventure of it all? You know, you were then, you know, now you're able to interview. Everyone knows who you are. Everyone knows what to expect. The production values, what's going on behind the camera. I'm sure it all runs a lot smoother than it did then. But it's the times now when you look back on those times when it did feel like you were a band sort of rocking up every night, and you think, God, that was the best time. They were the best bits.
Yeah, I think that's true, and it's a good analogy. It was like being in a band, because we were a band of brothers, and also we were such a small group of people. We're probably tenfold in terms of the size for every game now to what we were originally. Nobody knew us. It was pioneering. It was buccaneering. People didn't know what we were all about. And we had to entertain. It was because the thing for us as well, we had a lot of very good football journalists, both in front of camera and behind, right at the start of Sky. And one thing that was clear, we had Murdoch was the owner, and we had other people within the building who were steeped in British football. But what they understood straight away from the people in the production department was the English public, the football supporting public, the British public are no mugs. We cannot serve up a load of old tosh and expect them to buy it. They won't. We made it very... So, now, people thought we had lots of gimmicks. We did. Sumo wrestlers, fireworks, dancing girls, etc., etc. But they were very limited and went away very quickly. We said, this has to be based on what people want to talk about. But still today, many of the old adages of 30 years ago apply. If I talk to new commentators or pundits, we will say that don't use words you don't normally use. Don't tell me what I can see. And in an ideal world, this conversation that you're having, this analysis, will be sound like two people in a pub having a chat about it, a back and forth. And that's how, you know, you must never, ever forget that our viewers are our customers. Simple as that. We've got to serve up exactly what they want. And that's the challenge. And where, to your original point, yes, of course, they were thrilling in the early days. It was held together by bits of string, and the string was nearly broken an awful lot. But now we've become, if you like, the establishment. We've become what we railed against. And the challenge for us now is to keep reinventing ourselves and stay relevant.
There we are. Read it. Cheers, Jeff. Tales from the Fifth Land by Jeff Greaves. It is out on Macmillan. You can get it from all the places you get your books from, wherever that might be, whether it's online or at bookshops. It is very, very, very much worth reading. Foreword by Alan Shearer as well. Thanks a lot to Jeff for writing it and for coming on and having a chat about it. You'll be able to find it anywhere you want to go and do that sort of thing. And now let's get back over with the rest of the show. And that was part four, 2028. Andy says, correct me immediately and sort that stuff out. Quickfire Christmas round, because we're all a bit D-mob happy. Avenue HQ is practically empty, by the way. Everyone's decided they're going to go and enjoy the Christmas. Very quickly, Mike, best thing on the dinner?
Oh, that's difficult for me, you know, because I have two Christmas dinners.
Mike, don't have to brag.
let me talk the listeners through it.
I think different ones, have
two different ones. We have like the classic turkey with all the stuffing, all that good stuff. Then we have like a Nigerian one as well. So like with jollof rice, with some plantain.
Ooh.
Really. So like, I'd have to pick one from both. So I'm going to go, on a classic Christmas dinner, I do love pigs in blankets. I think they're the absolute business. And then on my Nigerian kind of dinner, like obviously you can't go wrong with a jollof rice. One of the best things out there. So
I would take the rice over the pigs in blankets myself. Sharp, best thing on a Christmas dinner?
Sprouts, but not Pardon? Like... Not like basic bitch sprouts, like sprouts with like pine nuts, bit of pancetta.
Pure
I've had them
through.
Before in like soy and honey, but probably not on a Christmas dinner. But basically posh sprouts.
Excellent stuff, Phil.
It is the pigs in blankets, isn't it? Because they're such a rarity, yeah. Really. I mean, you could theoretically have them all the time, but you don't, do you?
Well, I think the Greggs deal has ruined the pigs in blankets because I get bacon and sausage on a barm.
But you're not having it with gravy and like roast potatoes and stuffing.
Stuffing would be my answer. Favorite ever TV Christmas special, Sean?
Don't really watch them. Don't really watch telly on Christmas Day, yeah, around Christmas.
So, but like an episode of something?
Literally nothing.
Okay.
I know what your answer is.
What's my answer?
Is it Morecambe and Wise?
1977. Yep. Mike?
I don't know. Probably EastEnders. I always watch around Christmas time. And there's one episode, I think it's when any EastEnders fans out there, when Max gets caught cheating on with Stacey, if anyone's watched it, I think that's around Christmas time, decades ago, maybe like a decade and a bit ago. So that's probably like my favourite Christmas special that comes to mind anyway. I'm sure there's others.
Okay, Phil?
Gavin and Stacey was very good.
It was a good Christmas special, that one, yeah, excellent.
Shame about James Corden, but...
There's nothing we can do about
collateral.
It.
Collateral.
Yeah, you've got to put up with it, haven't you? One way or another. Selection boxes and their majesty. What's your favourite type of selection box and what's the first thing you eat out of it? Mike?
All the toffees from Quality Street. I think that's the right answer, in my view.
Okay, Sean?
So Quality Street's a selection box, yeah? Or did they do a selection box version?
I mean Christmas chocolates.
Yeah. I feel like I don't eat the Cadbury's ones I could think of. I'll go straight for a crunchy. Sometimes if they've got Freddos in, I'd...
The Freddo is a really good chocolate delivery system, I think.
In what sense?
It's because it's got a level of sturdiness about it. Mm. Three bites, but you know you've had it. I'm into the Freddo. I think it's got something.
And I'd swerve around fudge and curly whirlies. Not that arse.
Oh, I love those.
A lot of effort to eat and they get stuck in your teeth. Yeah.
They do get stuck in your teeth.
It's like it's worth, you feel like you've earned the right to eat it though when you are eating it. It's such an effort.
Yeah, probably burn calories.
Like a Ferrero Rocher, you know.
You like a Ferrero Rocher?
Ferrero Rocher.
Fuck off.
Yeah. I thought you didn't expect that, did you? Oh. Didn't expect that, did you?
I did not see that coming.
Oh. That's a posh selection box.
Yeah. Oh, honestly, what do you do in Hightown? Yeah. If you had to pick one of Craig Cannon or Josh Sexton to join your Christmas meal, and Mike, you could have them both because you've got two meals. Which one would you choose? Mike,
I'm probably going Sexton, you know, just because he's got an incredible taste in music. So we've had a few music chats in the past, and I think we could just chat for hours about music. Love Hannon, but I'm going to go Sexton for the music chat.
It's allowed. It's allowed. Don't worry at all. And I'm very, very much into people not picking Craig on this. To be honest with you. Sean.
You'll like my answer then. I'd go for Josh because I reckon he is hands down the nicest person I've ever met in my life. And he always puts a smile on my face whenever I see him. And I reckon he'd give me the last roasty on his plate.
Okay. Phil.
Josh in an attempt to get him to bully him to run more at football.
I mean, other thing. People have attempted other things.
I'll try. Honestly, Toby, has anyone tried the Christmas dinner?
Has anyone put the Christmas dinner? Yeah. And as he's eating it, absolutely said.
Chase him round.
Have you ever thought about tracking back? Exactly. That sort of thing. Yeah. Excellent stuff. And last one is, what cash amount for a charity of your choice would it take for you to do the Santa Dash in a blue suit? I've lots of theories about the Santa Dash in a blue suit. One of them is that you should only be allowed to do the Santa Dash in a blue suit if you will wear the blue suit all year round. Sean, what amount of money would it take for you to the Santa Dash in a blue suit? All going to charity, you don't benefit from it personally.
Well, if it's for charity, then loads, obviously. But I am just, I'm not that bitter. I actually go up my way to like have blue things to like send Evertonians.
I've got loads of blue. Somebody, I've got loads of blue. I'm wearing blue jeans right now. We all wear blue stuff. it's that I think. Yeah, it's the blue Santa suit. I think sends out a very clear signal. Mike, would you wear a blue Santa suit?
I would, you know, I'm not against blue as a colour, so I would wear the blue suit. Why not? I don't wind them up as well, so why not?
Very magnanimous,
exactly.
Philip.
Wearing blue is like does the opposite effect. It just sends
exactly,
it really well.
Exactly.
So I would do it for free simply because all the other blue Santas would think you were a blue. So you'd be able to have some fantastic conversations. You'd have blue chat, and you'd be able to be like just the opposite of what they all are whilst they think you're a blue. You'd be able to like, you know, this manager can't be having him, mate. Not having. And you'd honestly, the amount of fun you would get out of it, you wouldn't. Do you know what? I'd do it. I'd pay 50 quid to do it.
Marv, the stuff's like going to Denby. All right, then. The gaffer in his press conference. I'll go to Denby in a bit, by the way, Phil. I think I'm out.
The pub or the place in Wales?
The pub. We've done the place in Wales in the past. In his press conference, Sean, you said before, he looked delighted. I mean, first and foremost, it reminds us that he probably doesn't hate all the journalists. He'd just rather not see them every 3 days. A change is as good as a rest. He was even nice to Mike Hughes. I think it's fair to say he looked delighted by...
Did you hear his Five Live press conference last night?
No.
He basically told Juliet Ferrington off for coming with a chest infection and not wearing a mask.
Did he?
It was mad.
Absolutely incredible. There is, Sean. He looked delighted. And it feels determined, desperate to be getting the games back. And I think that this is... It sort of struck me a little bit, really, that he's... You know, he's probably felt like he's kicking around a little bit for 7 weeks. Although football is happening, it's not his football. And I just sort of get the impression he's determined to get his side into really, really good shape for this period that's coming. And I just thought he seemed really enthused.
Yeah, given that we've just been beaten by one of our biggest rivals, Rob the Cup, we're actually getting quietly mounting a lot more injuries than the front line does worry me. But he just looks like a person who knows something good is coming. I don't know what it is, but he just looks like he's like really calm about everything that's coming up. I guess the season, but obviously the wider narrative about what's happened with the club. But he said, I guess they were talking about investment again. He said he's not against it, which I think we all know by now. But he said, I'm convinced it will be good. The future will be bright. So I was like, sound, I love that. You know something's coming. I don't know if we know the same thing. But even when they were asking about Bellingham and Jan, he just laughed. And it was, yeah, I don't know. It's one of them like Heat magazines where like you read into body language to a mad degree. But yeah, something tells me just we're going to be surprised by something soon and it's going to be nice. And I'm into it.
What do you think he wants? I mean, I think he has that vibe. He's very, very good at it all the time, but I think he like almost views like he can shift football with his own mood, Sean, and maybe we read too much into that therefore, but there are certain times when I see him in certain press conferences, and today's a really good one, where I feel like, is he doing the thing where he shifts football with his own mood again, as though he's got this sort of unbelievable, weirdly magical power? But I feel as though that is very much his vibe in some of these, and you wonder if we're just getting to see what he's doing in the public face, and then behind the scenes he's like that, but times 10, because he's shifting his footballers with his mood.
Yeah, he did. He said he's a natural optimist, doesn't he? And I think maybe he's just buzzing about the challenge to make things right. And, you know, it wasn't quite a halfway point when we finished for the World Cup, was it? I think we were just about a third into the season, so there's still so much to go for. He's obviously seen stuff in the break that has given him hope. And then maybe there's something that might happen in Jan that's going to bolster the squad. But yeah, maybe it's... what's it called? You think something good and then it happens.
Manifesting.
Yeah, he's just manifesting a good season and I'm into it.
I'm into the manifesting, but injuries are annoying, Mike. I'd like him to manifest no more injuries, please. That is... It feels as though it's tough enough at the minute without sort of losing Firmino for a period of time when we knew we were going to have to use him and rely upon him. You know, there's a couple of others as well. It is frustrating with the injuries.
It is, and it feels like we're just being really unfortunate with the injuries. The Jota one feels... a bit unfortunate. The Diaz one feels hugely unfortunate. And Firmino, you know, altering his plans for City game again feels hugely unfortunate. And I think the issue we've had in recent seasons is that all our injuries seem to be condensed into one particular position in the pitch. So we obviously had a centre-back season. We've had a few issues in midfield in the past. Now we seem to be like all of our forwards bar two are fit. And that's obviously a concern. So I hope moving forward that, you know, obviously Diaz will be out for a while, but hopefully Jota's back in January, start of February. Hopefully Firmino's not out for too long. But I just worry with kind of the number of games we have coming up. I mean, January's lighter schedule is still mentioned than usual, but I just hope no one else picks up a knock in that area of the pitch. Like, I hope Darwin doesn't pick up a knock in that area of the pitch, because then you're really looking at like sort of...
You best not be manifesting here, Mike.
No. This is anti-manifesting. I'm anti-manifesting here.
Okay, so, yeah, but it's like thinking about pink elephants now, mate. You know, that's my head's only in one place now. We need to unmanifest quickly.
Unmanifest. So we'll be fine. Everyone's going to stay fit. Everyone's going to stay happy. And we're going to win loads of games. And have a good Christmas.
Marvellous. Excellent. Top spirit. That's what I'm about. Emery's good, though, Phil. I'm worried about Villa. I'm going to keep saying I think we've had hard lines with when we play people this season. It's mad that all three of the Midlands teams, when we played them, will be far stronger than they were in the first period of the season, the first sort of 14 games. And we're going to play them six times in the second period of the season, when I think they're going to be markedly better. But all of that said, I feel like it's going to be a difficult place to go on Boxing Day, I think, and I would take 0-0 at half time.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. We've seen him before. We've had him severe We've had him Villarreal. We had him Villarreal last
Arsenal,
season.
Arsenal,
I think Arsenal is a different kettle of fish with him though, because I don't think the way Arsenal were really allowed him to display what he is about in terms of how he sets a team up and how he manages and how he gets what he gets out of footballers. Whereas an Aston Villa, who are sort of a middle of the road Premier League club, are probably where he is best at. If you look at some of the teams he's done, you know, what he did at Sevilla was fantastic. Because Villarreal, I think, again, wasn't amazing at PSG, wasn't amazing at Arsenal. They're the two biggest jobs I think he's had. But I think he was okay at Valencia as well. He's just generally able to get teams who are, say, the 12th best, he can get them 7th best. And that is probably a similar thing. That's what Villa should probably be currently aspiring to, isn't it? So he's had the time to do it on the training ground, because I think they lost 4 players to the World Cup.
That was all, very, very few.
And, you know, one of them is the goalkeeper. You know, we covered this the other day on the show where I bantered Heaton about goalkeepers not being real footballers.
Not real footballers.
No, not at all. So what it means is they've had a long time now to for his ideas to get across and him to put his ideas into play, and they'll be difficult. It's also 5:30 on Christmas Boxing Day under the lights at Villa Park. It'll be loud. It'll be
the whole tent.
It will be. It's a great ground. It's a proper English football ground.
I absolutely love it.
Yeah, it's great. Love it. It will not be a nice environment for Liverpool. So at half time, 0-0 would be fine. If you're winning, obviously it's better. But you take 0-0.
Just quick. Everyone thinks obviously Van Dijk starts. Yeah. Everyone thinks Henderson starts. Feel free to dispute if you think at any stage. Everyone thinks Fabinho starts in there as well. I'm going to say Trent starts, but it wouldn't surprise me if we get an hour of Gomez and then half an hour of Trent off the bench, especially if he's been ill. That wouldn't surprise me in the slightest, but we'll sort of...
Did he say somebody else that played had been ill as well?
Yeah, I think Chamberlain. I don't know.
Chamberlain, that was it,
But Chamberlain gets 45 minutes. Yeah. And that's going to segue into my question. Who do we think starts in the front three? It'll be Nunez, it'll be Salah. Mike, who do you think the other one will be?
I think it'll be Chamberlain, and actually, I think he deserves a lot of credit for his cameo. Of all the things that we can talk about, taking encouragement from the game, his cameo was really good. And Chamberlain's someone that's been written off so many times, but I actually think he can be a useful player for us over the spell of the season, like he was around the spell of the season last time round, where he scores against, I think, Brentford, he plays well against Palace, if I remember correctly. So I wouldn't bet against him having a decent run for us. Now, I'd like to see him on the left-hand side, given how well he played against City.
Sean, do you think it'll be Chamberlain?
Yeah, straight in there. I think, you know, obviously everyone on the pitch, he had a physical presence. He was driving the ball forward, quite explosive. I'm happy to see him back in. I think Carvalho, away at a ground like that, I think he'd disappear.
Wouldn't shock me if it was like a 4-4-2 type thing, and it was Thiago, Henderson, Fabinho and Elliot with Nunes and Salah, because I think they're probably going to go 4-4-2, at least we might try and match them all. They also wouldn't be expecting that either, so... Might see something a bit different, who knows?
Prediction, Phil?
I think we'll win 1-0.
I think we'll win 1-0 as well. 1-0 is where I'm
I think it'll be a tense last 10 and we'll be fighting things back. But
it'll be. I think it's going to be a brutal, brutal affair. And our expectations should be pretty low. But I think we'll win 1-0. Sean?
I think with our best back line...
Barring Konate. Konate's not going to be there.
But it's back to our best... best defence, Trent back. I think if we just play with a bit more fire in our belly and don't get pushed over and then don't even fucking kick off about it and just stay on the floor.
It's right, Sean.
If all of the above happens, then 2-0. I'm still fuming about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Mike?
Yeah, 2-1 and hopefully show some fire. Like, I can't believe Fabinho gets pushed over like that and nothing happens. Like, of all the things that annoyed me yesterday, that was the most annoying thing by far. So hopefully 2-1 and some fire.
Excellent stuff. No, I'm 100% behind that. I would have quite... Also, you'd have got Gundogan sent off, conceivably, if you'd have reacted the right way.
Maddie didn't even get booked.
It's insane.
Because he booked Rodri and Fabinho at the same time, didn't he?
Yeah.
And then didn't book Gundogan.
Yeah.
And that was by far worse than what either of those two did.
Exactly. It was absolutely ridiculous. It was absolutely ridiculous. Let's just see the way in which it goes. Gutman referenced this week, and it's just sort of come up again with the manager today. Cloud busting by Kate Bush. I just know that something good is going to happen, but just saying it could even make it happen. Thank you very much to Sean, to Mike, and to Phil. Whatever you're doing, have a fabulous Christmas. Thank you for listening to the Anfield Wrap and being part of everything that we do. It is a pleasure to be able to do it. We shall see you all very, very soon indeed, back after Christmas, going to Villa Park. It's going to be brutal. Liverpool are going to win 1-0. It's going to be the best night of your life. See you later. Sports Social Podcast Network.